I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The prison population in the United States has increased dramatically in the last 35 years, from about 320,000 in 1980 to more than 2 million today. The war on drugs and tough sentencing laws are two of the main reasons so many are behind bars. The Coalition for Public Safety, a new organization of liberal and conservative groups, has found common ground and is making it their mission to reform the criminal justice system. Those groups include the ACLU, Koch Industries, Right on Crime, Freedom Works, the Center for American Progress, among others. We were fascinated by this development and wanted to know more, and we asked Mark Levin and Allison Holcomb to join us on Radio Times. Mark Levin is Right on Crime's policy director, as well as the director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation based in Austin. And Mark Levin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. And also with us, as I said, Allison Holcomb. She's the National Director for the ACLU's campaign to end mass incarceration. Allison Holcomb, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much, Marty.
This has been described as a kind of strange bedfellows group, so let me ask you both the same question. Allison, I'll start with you. What is in this for the ACLU to be part of this coalition?
You know, the ACLU has been a long-time proponent of fairness and due process and justice within our criminal justice system, and have been very concerned about the increasing crisis of mass incarceration and how it is relegating huge segments of our population to second-class citizenshipness. And so by joining together with, you know, our unlikely partners on the right, as it were, we're able to capitalize on this growing awareness of the crisis and also to access new audiences with new messages. So we think we're poised to find solutions, advocate successfully for those solutions, and turn this problem around.
And for you, Mark Levin, as policy director for Right on Crime, what's in it for your organization?
Well, we began back in 2010 to provide a conservative platform for criminal justice reform, and we have a statement of principles that's signed by people like Jeb Bush, Newt Gingrich, Bill Bennett, the former drug czar, Grover Norquist, and many others who believe in, you know, limited government, personal responsibility, and that we ought to be just as skeptical of corrections programs in prisons as we are of government running health care, education, or other programs. And so we have really been trying to basically move from a system that grows when it fails to one that rewards results. And so this coalition represents a tremendous opportunity to bring together groups that don't agree on much else, but certainly agree that the criminal justice system is too big and too ineffective. And in many cases, it makes people worse rather than better. And we have a duty to taxpayers, to public safety, to turn that around. So this is, I think, a tremendous moment to do that.
And I want to know how we got here. And when you add up the people in prisons, people in jail, people under probation, people on parole, something like one in 33 adult Americans is under some kind of control of the criminal justice system. Allison, from your perspective, how do we get to this point?
Well, here's what's heartening about the opportunity to turn this around is that the way that we got here was political. This wasn't about American citizens all of a sudden drinking Kool-Aid and becoming more criminal in nature. This was directly related to politicians deciding in the 1980s to get tough on crime, to make street crime a political opportunity in elections, and we really saw just an escalation on both sides of the aisles of penalties, mandatory minimum sentences. Politicians were very wedded to the idea that this is how you secure your reelection, and that's really what's been driving the population growth over the past four decades.
And Mark, going back to you, people might not know the way we talk about crime in this country, but crime is down dramatically over the last couple of decades. Is that because so many people are behind bars?
Well, what the research has shown is basically it was about a fivefold increase in incarceration from the mid-70s to the mid-2000s, that accounted for about 25% to 33% of the drop in crime. But the rest was demographics, was improved policing, video cameras everywhere, and so forth. And so, and I think improvements, frankly, in community supervision. We've seen recidivism rates come down, but I think partly because of things like evidence-based practices, motivational interviewing, better forms of mental health and drug treatment. But what the research has shown is that essentially we did need to increase incarceration somewhat because, for example, in Texas in the early 80s, we were letting murderers and rapists out after serving a quarter or a third of their sentence because we had 30,000 prison beds. Now, you know, we went to, well, at the peak in Texas before we started our reforms back in 2007, 160,000 beds. Now we're back down close to 150. So the if you look at it, it's a pendulum. It swung too far, and we swept in a lot of nonviolent and low-risk people into prison. And actually, what the research is showing is that when you take somebody who is low-risk and nonviolent, you put them, they often go for 6 months or a year, very brief time. So you're not getting hardly any public safety benefit because the time they're in prison is so small. And then it turns out when they come back from prison, they can't get a job, they can't find a place to live, they're disconnected from their family, their church. They're actually more of a risk than when they came in, not to mention all the people they met while they were in prison. It's a criminogenic environment when you throw all these people together, often with a lack of programming. So I think that the research has shown we went too far, and at this point, the incarceration rate is so high, it's actually counterproductive.
And to you, Allison, picking up on what Mark just said about low-risk, nonviolent offenders, how much of this is because of the war on drugs?
The war on drugs has been a huge driver of our incarceration populations. At the federal level, more than 50%, just over 50% are there for drug offenses. In our state prisons, about 20% are there for nonviolent drug offenses. And what's most disturbing about the war on drugs is that that's an area where the racial disparities are most stark. What we know from scientific research is that races and ethnicities use drugs at roughly equal rates, but African Americans, Latinos and Latinas are multiple times, anywhere from 3 to 8 times or even higher in some jurisdictions, more likely to be arrested, convicted, and jailed for drug-related offenses. And we do. It's time for us to start asking the question. Actually, the voters are already way ahead of us on this and are already saying, look, treatment is the appropriate response for the problem of drug addiction, not jail cells. And so I think that's an excellent place for us to start in considering policy options for reform.
And Mark Levin from Right on Crime, is that something you would agree with?
Oh yeah, I definitely think that the it's not even a matter of opinion. Especially if you look at the federal system, the drug offenders are the largest group by far, and most of the astronomical increase in the federal prison system has been low-level drug offenders. And so originally, the whole idea of federal prosecutions on things that are already against state law was to get, you know, big-time international drug kingpins, huge traffickers, but instead it swept in a street corner drug dealers, people dealing very small amounts, typically to friends or relatives. And again, obviously it's not right, but there's already state laws to take care of that. Unfortunately, the federal laws have been a lot more severe, so these folks are going in for 10 or 15-year mandatory minimums, whereas in the state system they would have gotten a fraction of that time. So fortunately, there's some really good legislation pending in Congress, such as the Smarter Sentencing Act, that would roll back these extreme mandatory minimums. So, the drug issue also comes up with people stealing money to get drugs. So a good share of the property offenses that are filling up the criminal justice system are people, you know, engaged in whether it's shoplifting, hot checks, other forms of theft in order to get money for drugs. So we need to do much more in terms of treatment. And things like the Hawaii Hope Court have been very effective, where people are tested regularly, and if they fail, they do go to jail for the weekend, but they keep their job. That's had a two-thirds reduction in substance abuse and recidivism. So we need to be much more kind of cost-effective in dealing with this, and also realize it's a public health issue as much as it's a criminal justice issue.
Allison, do you think there's an appetite in Congress to deal with some of the reforms your group, the Coalition for Public Safety, your group is really championing?
You know, I do think that there are. You know, there are senators like Cory Booker, Rand Paul, again, you know, leaders from both sides of the aisle coming forward and saying the system is broken and we need to fix it. Now, in saying that, I offer up one caveat, is that while the drug offense statistics that we're talking about at the federal level are horrible and outsized, generally speaking, for the majority of that incarceration population nationwide, we're looking at state prisons and local jails. That's 2.2 million, right? There's about 200,000 people in federal custody compared to the 2.2 million in local and state custody. But what's important about Congress moving on this issue is the leadership that it demonstrates to the states. You know, it was Congress that was pushing these mandatory minimums in the 1980s and really creating an environment within the United States that drove the incarceration crisis in the direction that it went. And it would be wonderful for us to see leadership coming out of Washington, D.C., bipartisan leadership on this issue, to signal to the states that it's time for the country as a whole to look at this issue closely.
Mark, we have a Facebook comment from Lee. Says the first step to reform has to be to put an end to for-profit prisons. They should be deemed unconstitutional. Numbers of these for-profit prisons are making money on the numbers of people that we incarcerate in this country. Is it time to rethink that?
Well, I don't think it's unconstitutional. I think what we need to do is change the approach that we're doing, most states are doing, with regard to contracting. And the contracting, it's not just contracting with private companies to run prisons, but also many states also contract with either private companies or more often nonprofit organizations to operate treatment programs inside government prisons. They may also contract with companies to do outsource certain, like food service or whatever, in a state prison. But the bottom line is, the problem that I've seen is that in these contracts for private prisons, or often in for programming as well, there are not outcome measures, and there's no connection between the money that's paid and whether the outcomes are. So what we've suggested is there ought to be one kind of line item, which is a basic funding to keep the lights on or deliver the basics of the programming, but then there ought to be part of the funding based on reducing recidivism and also positive outcomes, like getting people GEDs or degrees, occupational, vocational certificates. So there is certainly a way to do this. In Great Britain, they've got a $100 million fund for these types of performance incentives, and it's with nonprofits. But I think that the problem is these contracts have basically been, states just look for the low bidder in some instances without regard to what are the outcome metrics that we want to see.
Almost, I'm going to break here, Allison. Are you in favor of performance incentives and metrics?
Well, the ACLU has gone on the record as saying that we oppose privatization of incarceration. And, you know, I think we are understandably very skeptical of the ability of taxpayers and their representative government to actually have adequate oversight of these facilities. You know, it sounds good to say, well, we can just build into the contracts that they're going to meet certain performance measures. But the reality is, especially in the case of the for-profit prisons, there's an incentive. There's an incentive to keep your customers coming back. There's incentive to cut corners. There's absolutely no incentive to invest in programming and humane conditions that protect the mental health of the people who are in custody and ensure that they're not going to come back through the door. So this might be an area where the bipartisan coalition has a little bit
Fair
more
enough.
Talking to do.
Okay, well, we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about the Coalition for Public Safety. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Allison Holcomb. She's the national director of the ACLU's campaign to end mass incarceration. Also with us is Mark Levin. He is the policy director for Right on Crime, also the director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And they are also, their organizations are part of the Coalition for Public Safety, a new organization of liberal and conservative groups coming together to reform the criminal justice system. to join our conversation, give us a call or actually send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be taking some calls later in the show, but we want to know what you think of this coalition and your ideas for how to reform the criminal justice system. Mark, let me go back to you and talk a bit about juvenile justice. And do you think that zero tolerance has sort of fed the incarceration as it relates to young offenders or young people charged with crimes?
Yes, absolutely. It's been a major problem. The many people call it the school to prison pipeline. We also have a judge in Texas who called it passing the paddle. But the reality is, what we found is so many kids in Texas, in particular, were issued citations, Class C misdemeanor tickets, which are like speeding tickets for things like chewing gum in class and making too much noise. We actually had to go in and pass state laws here in Texas the last several sessions to put a stop to that. Previously, school districts could designate any violation of their code of conduct as a criminal offense and just hand out these tickets like lollipops. And so the research has shown, and the other big problem is the out-of-school suspensions, which are 600,000 a year in Texas. And the problem is the research shows that when you kick kids out of school who are having behavior problems, in most instances, it's not an Ozzie and Harriet situation where they're at home having somebody help them with their schoolwork those days that they're out of school. Usually it's a single mom who's working, and the kid is out there on the street, often getting involved in gang activity. We found kids that were on out-of-school suspension were 32 times more likely to be arrested during those days than those in school. So we need to, most of these kids are behind to begin with academically. They need more time in school. They need after school, programs and so forth. They can do school service and help clean the school afterwards if there, if there's a, it needs to be a sanction for some type of misbehavior. But we also need to look at actually correcting misbehavior. The other big issue is truancy. We have a lot of great bills here in Texas this session to decriminalize truancy so that we bring the kids to school if we pick them up and we have someone go out to the house and find out why they're truant, what's going on in the family, instead of sending them to municipal court and giving them a criminal record. So the reality is there's a problem across the country with kicking too many kids to the curb, and we often call what we have in this country a dropout crisis, but if you look at the longitudinal study, a lot of them are pushouts. Before they dropped out, they were put in out-of-school suspension many times. They were truant. They got in the habit of not going to school. And so we're actually, with current policies, I think, promoting kids dropping out, which is exactly the opposite of what we need to do.
Allison, anything you want to add to that?
No, I mean, Mark has really hit the nail on the head. It's, policies that are adopted at the school level, whether it's excessively punitive responses to what is getting categorized as a discipline a discipline offense or being disruptive in class, to, some allege that there are issues with how schools are funded and test scores and whether that contributes to pushing certain kids out of school. It's a significant problem. And close to where you are, Marty, the West Virginia ACLU affiliate's been very active with the legislature there in encouraging state legislators to change laws about school truancy. There's one example of a young woman who was found to be truant, was incarcerated for being truant, and then her days spent incarceration were counted against her as additional days of being truant. So it's just, ridiculous policies like that are contributing to the cycle of families, especially those that are struggling socioeconomically, to get pushed in and out of schools, which, of course, leads not only to increased engagement with the criminal justice system, but permanent life trajectory changes. And it's a huge concern.
Well, Allison, going back to you and picking up on some of the things that Mark was talking about and what you were saying as well, do you think we just have too many behaviors and are now considered crimes, whether we're talking about juveniles or talking about adults? Have we kind of over-criminalized our country?
I think that's exactly what one of the biggest problems has been. It's been framed by some as saying, instead of incarcerating people that we are afraid of because they actually pose a public safety risk, we're using the criminal justice system to get back at people that we're just mad at. But we have taken the easy way out, at least you know, I think it in the beginning felt that way for dealing with a lot of issues, and we are very quick to slap a criminal penalty, a misdemeanor criminal penalty, and annoying types of behaviors. For example, here in the state of Washington, fully half of the cases that are getting pushed through our local municipal and district court cases are for driving with license suspended. And that just creates, you know, the cycle of more penalties, more fees, people not being able to pay that, people getting picked up and held in jail for failure to be able to pay a fine. So we're talking about this whole problem with debtors' prisons. And it's really where we are now is in a place of needing to step back and say, wait a second, are we using the criminal justice system as a tool for problems that other systems could address more effectively? And Mark's already touched on some of that. Our mental health systems, our substance abuse and addiction systems, education, jobs. There's so many other tools that we could be making more robust and addressing what are not really public safety problems, but just perhaps social challenges that we need to look at, you know, different approaches for them.
I mean, kind of nuisance issues, you're saying, Allison.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, let me go back to you and actually put something else on the table here. We're talking about efforts to reform the criminal justice system. In fact, the Coalition for Public Safety, a new organization of both liberal and conservative groups, are making it their mission to reform the criminal justice system. And our guests are Allison Holcomb, National Director of the ACLU's Campaign to End Mass Incarceration, and Mark Levin, he's Policy Director for Right on Crime. And again, to join our conversation, I see comments coming in. Send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Mark, let me go back to you and go back to those people that are being let out of prison. They're, I guess, under probation. But we know recidivism rates are pretty gosh darn high when you look across the board. What efforts can be used to address that problem?
Sure. Well, you know, in most states, there's some form of parole or post-release supervision. One of the problems, though, is nationally close to a third of inmates are released without any supervision. They're people that max out, that they serve day for day their entire sentence in prison. And so that creates a lot of problems. Of course, there's no accountability for them after they've left. There's nobody to, I mean, the counties, the cities that they're coming back to don't know that they're being released or who they are. In Texas, we do require that they have a valid home plan, but certainly there are some states probably where they may become homeless. Of course, a number of them have serious mental illness, and so typically they would have been on sometimes several psychiatric drugs while they were incarcerated, and then if they're released without any supervision, there's really no one to follow up to make sure they're still able to continue with their medications and other treatment that they may need. So one of the things we've been working on is legislation to basically stop the practice of having people max out their whole sentence in prison and at least have a year or so of transition to the community, because there's research showing that that will reduce new offenses by about 36%. Of course, we also need to improve the way we do parole. You know, decades ago, there was a sign in the California Parole Office that said, trail them, nail them, and jail them. And instead, what we tried to do in Texas, I think with considerable success, because our parole revocation rate is half of what it was just 5 or 6 years ago, but we've tried to have a culture where officers, parole officers, see it also as part of their duty to help these people succeed, help them find employment, help make sure they have stable housing, connect them with people in the community, with churches. We have on our parole in Texas, we have some individuals who are, you know, basically it's ecumenical. They're not a specific faith, but they connect them to different congregations that are willing to receive parolees, and of course that the parolee would like to is interested in, because a lot of people become very isolated, unfortunately, from their family. We make it too hard to visit people in prison, which is another problem, but they become isolated from their family, friends. Sometimes it's been so long, most people they know have passed away. And if, so if we don't create positive social connections for them, they're likely to fall back into a gang and negative peer influences, which is a real driver of recidivism.
Allison, when you look at the prison population, I realize that we're talking, I guess we're sort of mixing up federal, state, and local prisons, but what percentage of them do you think actually could be released and it would not affect the crime rate or make people feel unsafe?
You know, I actually think that we could release half of people that are incarcerated right now without increasing any public safety risk. And here's why. There are, we talked a bit about those offenders that are incarcerated that are there on charges that we need to take a hard look and see if it should even be treated as a crime in the first place. You know, the overwhelming majority of drug offenses are for possession, for example, and they're really issues of public health and not public safety. Then when you look at property offenses, assuming that all of the people that are convicted of some sort of property offense are actually committing a crime, they're taking property from somebody else, we ought to ask ourselves the question, why do we think it's appropriate to put them in a cell? Why does someone that is committing a nonviolent offense need to be put in a cage? There's not a public safety threat there. Why can't they be monitored in the community? Why can't they be working to make restitution to the people that they took property from? Why can't they be taking classes or doing something productive that would prevent them from recidivating? So that's a huge segment of the people that are behind bars right now. So I think we have a lot of room to move and can actually do that fairly quickly.
But do we have the staff? Do we have the services to provide those kinds of treatments in the community?
Well, and that's where we get to this question of what does justice reinvestment look like? There are a number of states that have been engaging with the Council on State Governments and engaging in sentencing reforms, reducing length of sentences, and capturing the savings to the criminal justice system and investing it back into programs that are intended to promote public safety and reduce recidivism. Maybe we need to look a little bit harder and see if we can push a little further on that. And so with some of the sentence lengths that could be changed in other offenses where we agree that people should probably spend some time incarcerated, there are opportunities to recoup those savings and put them into other programs. Eventually, if we really want to see major criminal justice system savings, we're going to have to talk about closing some of these facilities. And that may mean job retraining. What are we going to do with the corrections officers that are in these facilities that we want to close, especially in rural communities where perhaps the entire community depends on that prison as a source of employment? So we have some tough conversations ahead of us, but we can do this. We can find the solutions, and we can ensure that we're protecting public safety and being fair during the transition process.
Mark, I'm curious about whether the Coalition for Public Safety has consensus when it comes to civil asset forfeiture. I know that's kind of in the weeds and kind of wonky, but it was an issue, certainly is an issue here in the Philadelphia area. Does the coalition have agreement on this?
We're still in the process of kind of going through the details, but I think there's general agreement that we want to make reform of civil asset forfeiture a priority for the coalition. Obviously, there's a variety of proposals. I think the strongest one is to simply end civil asset forfeiture and have criminal forfeiture where, you know, you have to be, in order for the government to keep your property, you certainly should have to be convicted of a crime. Now, kind of the questions come in as to basically when can the government take your property initially, you know, before you're convicted. And I think that the original purpose of civil asset forfeiture was to go after, you know, international drug cartels where they could hide large amounts of money, you know, in a Swiss bank account or whatever, and you wanted to be able to take that up front. I think there's a way to allow for that, but to stop a lot of the abuses that have been occurring where people just pulled over for speeding or any traffic offense, for example, the police department can take all their stuff. And, of course, usually it doesn't amount to more than a few thousand dollars at the most, and it would cost more than that to hire a lawyer to get it back. And the whole problem currently is even if you're not convicted, the burden is on you, even if you're exonerated, to go file a civil lawsuit to get your stuff back. And, of course, there's a really perverse financial incentive because law enforcement and sometimes prosecutors in Texas, it's split evenly between them. It's an eat-what-you-kill model. They keep the proceeds for their own use. So, for example, in Texas, we had prosecutors take trips to Hawaii, go on vacation, and also buy margarita machines with the proceeds of these forfeitures.
Wow. Let me pick up on that, Allison, go back to you. I'm also thinking about the Justice Department report last week on law enforcement practices in Ferguson, Missouri, One of them was just the role that, race has played in Ferguson when it came to arresting people. Also, the fact that the city raised a fair amount of money depending on the people that they arrested. When you look at criminal justice reform, should we fold this into the conversation as well?
Well, the reality is we can't talk about America's history with criminalization without talking about America's history with race. And that's a very complicated and sensitive conversation, but it's one that is long overdue and many people are calling for it. And it's broader than the criminal justice system, right? I mean, it touches on our education system. It touches on our economy. It goes back to allegations of the Southern Strategy pitting poor white people against poor black people. And of course, goes even farther back with this country's history with slavery, with lynchings, terrorism in the South. And we see the South is, of course, the place where incarceration rates are the highest. Texas and Florida are two of the states that have the highest incarceration populations. And we see racial disparities throughout. So that is part of the conversation that we need to have both within the context of mass incarceration and more broadly. And it trickles all the way down to policing, as you've already pointed out, Marty, and all the way up to who gets what sentences, how long are the sentences for the same offenses, what happens to people when they're incarcerated, and at how many points does racial disparity, whether intentional or through implicit bias, play into outcomes for various individuals in the criminal justice system.
And Mark, we're almost up on our second break here. Do you have a quick comment on that?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the really disturbing things in Ferguson is there's 3.6 warrants per household, arrest warrants. Now, most of those are for unpaid traffic tickets, but they need to come up with a way to, in other communities as well, is have people voluntarily come forward who can't afford to pay these types of minor warrants, and often it ends up being $500 for failure to appear plus $300 for the traffic ticket or whatever, that they can come forward and, for example, do community service if they're indigent, not go to jail. And if they would create a way for people to voluntarily come forward and know that they could do community service for a few weekends and discharge these things. The problem is that when everyone has a warrant for their arrest or a few warrants, what are the chances they're going to report serious crimes because they know that there's a warrant for their arrest or that they're going to be available as a witness to violent crimes, for example. So it really undermines public safety. And, of course, the BOJ report also provided some pretty strong evidence that basically these fines are just being used as a revenue source to run the government. And it's not unique to Ferguson.
Well, I got to jump here only because we're up on a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Mark Levin. Also with us, Allison Holcomb. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. There aren't many issues today where conservatives and liberals agree, but it looks like there is growing agreement about the need for criminal justice reform. Recently, the ACLU, Koch Industries, the Center for American Progress, Right on Crime, FreedomWorks, and several other groups formed the Coalition for Public Safety to tackle this issue. And that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. Again, talking with Allison Holcomb, National Director of the ACLU's campaign to end mass incarceration, and Mark Levin. He's the policy director for Right on Crime, also director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and that's located in Austin. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Would it be fair to say, Allison, that looking sort of overall at the goal for the coalition is bring down the prison population and bring down or maintain a low crime rate?
I think that those are both goals as well. And I think that there's also a commitment to ensuring or in fact reestablishing fairness and due process within the criminal justice system. And in saying that, I'm thinking specifically about the fact that Koch Industries, which a lot of people might be surprised to hear, has actually dedicated significant resources to indigent defense, into assuring that indigent defendants have adequate public defense and have access to due process. So it's not just about civil asset forfeiture when it comes to people who have significant assets, but also also for poor people that are getting their cars taken and other poor people. So I think there is a commitment there, too, to making sure that the American criminal justice system is meeting the standards of fairness, integrity, and justice that all American citizens want.
And to you, Mark, and then we'll get to some callers here. We haven't really talked about the victims of crimes, but how does that factor into the coalition and the kinds of reforms we've been talking about?
Well, we've worked a great deal on restorative justice approaches such as victim offender mediation, for example. And so one of the instances, if, let's say, a 10-year-old steals something out of my garage, we could have a months of a trial and all of that. But why not instead, as a victim, why wouldn't I have an option to say, I'd rather just sit down with that 10-year-old in a mediation and reach a binding agreement for him to give me my stuff back and for community service. And he doesn't have a criminal record if he performs that, and the research has shown this works over 90% of the time. And so victims, I think we need to give them more options than just the adversarial justice system. And these types of, whether it's victim offender mediation or sentencing circles, these approaches typically get much higher victim satisfaction, much more restitution collected. In the traditional system, a lot of times the government gets the first cut of whatever money is collected from fines and fees, and the victim is still waiting for restitution. So our view is we need to really prioritize the individual victim when it comes to property crimes, for example, rather than getting money to the government.
How do you see victims, and I guess the role that they play in what we've been talking about, Allison?
You know, I think this is such an important piece of the conversation, and that our criminal justice system really has gotten distorted quite a bit by the prioritization of the prosecutor's scorecard. That we think of the criminal justice system as delivering wins, delivering convictions. That's rewarded through certain kinds of funding. How many arrests have you made? How many drugs have you seized? And if we're really going to have a serious conversation about what our criminal justice system should look like, we should be thinking about those that it's really designed to help. You know, we think of our criminal justice system as separating the offender from the victim, as being about the offender has broken laws that the state has created, and therefore the state is really in the position of enforcing justice. But victims frequently get lost in that, in the sense of some of the services that could be available to them. Mark's talking a little bit about restorative justice, which is, I think, a critical component of this conversation. And it can apply not only to those property offenses where the 10-year-old has stolen something from your garage, but what about cases of violent offenses? Not all victims, of course, are going to want to sit down with the person who has hurt them, but some do. And the barriers to that kind of conversation and restoration are significant. And we certainly do not spend enough money on mental health for people who've been emotionally traumatized by different kinds of offenses. And I think we could achieve better results in our communities and in public safety if we were more thoughtful about what victims need.
Let me see what Diane from, it looks like Warminster, has to say. Hi, Diane, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, this is an excellent program, and I'm very excited to hear these issues discussed. And what I'm wondering is how we can expand the program to look at some of the grassroots organizations that are out there that are currently working with returning citizens. We have an excellent example in Philadelphia, the Center for Returning Citizens, which was founded by John Guy Harrell and which provides holistic counseling for people who have been released so they can reconnect to their families and the community. And the people that know best some of these challenges are the people who have been through them. And TCRC, for example, their programs are run by returning citizens.
Interesting.
It's a way to we need to look at the grassroots programs that are out there and work to improve them and provide funding. I'm a volunteer with this program. I believe there are others out there, but we don't
sure.
know. We don't know what's out there.
Well, Diana, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And what I hear from both of you, actually, Mark, and you, Allison, and I'll put this first to you, Mark Levin, which is that we sort of know how to address this problem. The trick is trying to figure out how to create a system that is much more effective than what we have today. And what we hear from Diane, Mark, is that there are people on the ground doing this work, have the expertise. Sounds like they don't have a lot of money. I'm not sure money is always the solution to things, but there are people that know how to do this. We have to figure out how to make it more available, it seems.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was on a panel with Governor Sam Brownback of Kansas at a recent conference, and one of the things he talked about is they, of the 6,000 people they released from prison now, 4,000 have volunteer mentors from the community who start working with them while they're still behind bars 6 months before release. And of those who have the mentors, there's a 9% one-year recidivism rate versus 21% for those that don't. Mm-hmm. So that actually doesn't cost the state any money because they're volunteers. I guess there's some money in coordinating them, but certainly that's a very worthwhile endeavor. And so there are a lot of people out there in communities. Another example is there's a program that David Kennedy, who's a professor at the John Jay College, he has a national network for safe communities. And they do these call-ins, basically, where in areas, the main goal of it is to get rid of open-air drug markets where there's a lot of shootings and so forth. And so they have these call-ins where they police invite various individual gang members who are part of these open-air drug markets, but also their grandmothers, ministers from the community. And everybody kind of discusses what's going on, and there's also prosecutors there, and so there's a threat of prosecution if they don't desist, but there's also social services, job placement folks there. So they give them a real positive alternative. And it's about 90% of the not the leaders of the gang, but 90% of the kind of, they're usually young men involved in these gangs and open-air drug markets, go actually desist under pressure from, grandmothers and community members. And it's really been very effective in Boston and High Point, North Carolina, Cincinnati, and many other cities.
Diane, thanks for the call. Let me see what William from West Philadelphia has to say. William, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
The question that I have is, with the coalition that's currently in existence, are there any organizations that included who have leadership who were formerly incarcerated or convicted? I was formerly incarcerated and convicted, and for the last 20 years, I've been doing advocacy, and we've been talking about criminal justice reform. And now I've just recently become a part of an organization, Just Leadership USA, who has identified 20 leaders throughout the continental United States, and our overall mission is to reduce the prison population in half by the year 2030. And then on top of that, all of us are currently leading efforts, and more than often, we're not included in legislation that's drafted to affect criminal justice reform. We're excluded when it comes to funding with the organizations and programs which we're leading. So I'm really interested to hear whether or not we're at the table and we're driving the policy to actually get the outcomes that we collect.
Well, William, I appreciate the call. Excuse me, the call to Radio Times. Allison, I'm going to toss that to you.
Sure, absolutely. So thank you so much for mentioning Just Leadership, by the way. Glenn Martin, the founder of that in New York, important organization. I also want to call out a couple of other ones. There's Florida Rights Restoration Coalition in Florida. Also in New Orleans, there's a Project Vote run by Norris Henderson. Daryl Atkinson is another formerly incarcerated leader out of North Carolina doing important work here. You know, at the table in the coalition itself, the leadership conference, which is a coalition of many different organizations, is at the table. But also, you know, individuals who have been incarcerated are part of this conversation as well. But I just want to point out two things. First of all, it's absolutely accurate that the people who have been in the system are in a critical position, have firsthand knowledge to talk not only about what needs to be reformed within the system, but what could help in our communities to prevent people from being pushed into the system in the first place, what can help when they come out of the system to make sure that they don't come back, and then critical work that's happening right now is how do we restore the right to vote to these people, because civic engagement is such an important part of having a commitment to your society, to your fellow community members, and this is something I think that is critical. It doesn't necessarily float to the surface when we start talking about mass incarceration. It's not necessarily the first thing that people think about. But the fact that we have overwhelming numbers of disenfranchised people, predominantly from poor communities and communities of color, has a huge impact on the policies that this country adopts when it comes to the criminal justice system. And so that's work that needs to be included in this conversation as well.
William, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Back to you, Mark Levin. How will we know the Coalition for Public Safety has been effective? And I know, I realize you've just been organized in the last couple of weeks.
Sure. Well, and I will say also with regard to the last caller that actually I had dinner with Glenn Martin, the head of Just Leadership USA, just a couple weeks ago, and we're really looking forward to identifying ways we can work together. And the work they're doing to train formerly incarcerated persons to be powerful advocates for reform, I think, is really inspiring. And I think we also, one thing we haven't talked about is kind of expanding the way for ex-offenders to get things off their record eventually. And so we're working on that here in Texas, and Minnesota recently passed, as well as Indiana legislation, to basically allow people, the record could still be seen by law enforcement, but that they could have a non-disclosure of their criminal record. And, of course, there are some limitations on it in terms of the types of offenses and so forth. But I think we've, unfortunately, in most jurisdictions in this country, it's a scarlet letter. If you have a conviction even for a drug offense when you're 18, it's still on your record when you're 80. And it makes it very difficult to get a job, get an apartment, and so forth. As far as the coalition goes, I think we're seeing incredible momentum at the federal level. I think in some ways the coalition's already been a success. If you just look at the incredible amount of press coverage, the interest we've seen from policymakers in Congress and state legislatures. But I really think ultimately for all of us, the proof is in the pudding as far as actually having reforms enacted that, right-size our criminal justice system and that benefit public safety, that have people being able to go on and live productive lives without the burden of the criminal justice system actually in many ways making things worse rather than better.
Allison, I scribbled down the word family values. Do you see this as kind of a part of the family values issue?
Absolutely. I think values that speak across the spectrum to families, keeping families intact, compassion, second chances, redemption. These are values that speak to all Americans, and it is about keeping families safe, keeping families whole, and seeing families thrive.
And do you see it that way, Mark Levin?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things, if you look at it, the average woman in prison has 2 to 3 children, and most men in prison also have children that they're falling behind on in terms of supporting. And so the criminal justice system does break up a lot of families. And, of course, there are, situations where, of course, there are people that need to be in prison despite that. But unfortunately, by putting so many people in prison who aren't a threat to the public, we're needlessly tearing families apart. So I think that it is very much a pro-family issue.
And we're almost out of time here, Allison, but as someone who's involved with the ACLU, have you had to explain the ACLU's involvement with the Koch brothers and others that we would, that we more associate with conservative organizations and conservative values?
And I expect we'll continue having to explain it, just like Mark will have to keep explaining the association with the ACLU. But the ACLU has just historically always been an organization focused on the issues and finding solutions to issues that impact the civil liberties and civil rights of Americans. And we will partner with any organization or leader that is sincerely committed to pursuing those kinds of solutions.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Allison Holcomb, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to you, Mark Levin, as well. Mark Levin is Policy Director for Right on Crime, also Director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and Allison Holcomb, the National Director of the ACLU's Campaign to End Mass Incarceration. And they are part of this new organization called the Coalition for Public Safety. It's an organization of liberal and conservative groups, and they want to reform the criminal justice system. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of the show, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.